is Monday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, France mourns the terror attacks in Paris as police raid suspected Islamists across the country and French jets launch airstrikes in Syria against the Islamic State. Myanmar's National League for Democracy prepares to take power.
Aung San Suu Kyi has a great number of disadvantages. For a start, almost nobody in her political machine has any direct experience of running a 21st century political system.
It's all ahead. Well, France is still in mourning. However, the country went back to work today, just a few days after the attacks on Friday, which killed at least 129 people and more than 350 people were wounded. I'm joined now by VOA correspondent Daniel Scharf. Daniel, what is occurring today in Paris as the city continues to mourn?
Well, today at noon, there was a minute of silence that took place. We were in the main square where a lot of people have been gathering to show their respects and to mourn the loss of those who were killed on Friday. Hundreds, probably a couple thousand, maybe more people gathered at the Place de la République, and they marked the occasion with 1 minute of silence. It was followed by clapping by the crowd to show their solidarity with the victims and their families.
Is there still a large security presence, police presence on the streets?
Today in the square, I don't see as much of a security presence as I saw yesterday. But yesterday evening, just after there was a brief scare, they increased the very visual public presence of security. There were more police and military with guns walking around, but very calmly also, just to show that they had the area secure and to keep people from panicking, as we saw briefly yesterday evening when there was a scare that took place. But today it is not so overt. I don't see as many police in the square or the area nearby, although they certainly are here. There were a number of unmarked black vans that were parked in the area since the weekend. And we did have a number of police vans that were parked further down the street.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said today that French police have made more than 150 raids on suspected radicals. I'm assuming this has got a great deal of coverage in the French media.
Yeah, absolutely, of course. As the French authorities continue to look for those who were behind the attacks, those who were still on the loose, and others who may have been assisting with the attacks that took place. Certainly, all of France, Europe, and the world are very much concentrated on the investigation that's taking place. So lots of attention, lots of concern that, you know, this is not over yet. The Prime Minister also warned that further attacks could happen in the coming days, weeks, or months ahead. So people are still on edge and very vigilant. But at the same time, we also see very strong shows of solidarity, patriotism, that France will not be cowed by terrorists, that life will go on more or less as normal, although people will be very much aware of their surroundings and security because of these horrific attacks.
All right. Thanks very much, Daniel. That's Daniel Scharf reporting from Paris.
My pleasure.
Well, in the wake of Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris, France has stepped up its airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria while widening its international manhunt for a suspect believed to have played a part in coordinating the attacks. French President François Hollande called the attacks an act of war. And at the G20 summit, President Obama vowed to step up efforts to reach a peaceful transition in Syria and to degrade and destroy the IS group to prevent such future attacks. Benjamin Haddad is a research fellow and European analyst with the Washington-based Hudson Institute. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Europe has become the new front in the Syrian civil war.
We've seen this already with the flow of refugees that were fleeing the conflict in Syria. And now what happened in Paris is a new consequence of the situation in the Middle East. And we still need to have more information about the origins and the training. It appears that one of the terrorists who have been identified by the French police as a French citizen has trained in Syria in the winter of 2013-2014, and that this operation might have been planned from Syrian territory with the leadership of ISIS to expand the front in Europe.
With the migrant crisis now in full flower in Europe, what is it going to do for those who are trying to welcome these refugees and migrants?
There is a risk of a political backlash against the refugees, which I think would be very troubling because it would represent, I think, a real confusion with what is going on. A lot of these people are fleeing repression. They're fleeing exactly what's been happening in Paris these last few days: violence, terrorism, radicalism. There's been a Syrian passport that apparently belonged to a refugee that's been found next to the body of one of the suicide bombers. It's still very unclear at this point if this is a real passport or not. And there is a risk of rising populism and xenophobia in Europe after these attacks. And I think this is something that European leadership should be very vigilant about.
At the G20 summit in Turkey, world leaders vowed on Sunday a vigorous response to the terrorist attacks in Paris. Of course, as you know, French jets went after IS headquarters in Raqqa in Syria. Will there be a newfound unity in fighting Islamic State?
I mean, it's true that the French authorities privately say that they consider that the United States has taken the back seat on everything that's been going on in Syria. The French have had a very strong position on the ouster of Assad as the only possible solution to the Syrian crisis from the start. Strikes in Syria to prevent potential terrorist attacks against the French territory already this summer. But I think now there's going to be a willingness from European countries and hopefully from the United States to ramp up the fight against ISIS in Syrian territory. The risk, if the U.S. doesn't take the lead on this, is that European leaders will be more and more pressured to side with Russia, which appears to offer the only solution, which would be a catastrophe both for the transatlantic relation, but also for the situation in Syria, where saving Assad cannot possibly be a political solution to what's happening. I mean, that's the only offer and alternative that the Russians offer.
Well, Ben, of course, France has imposed a state of emergency, apparently the first in many decades. Has France turned a page in the fight against terrorism with this attack in Paris?
It certainly is a new phase of the war on terrorism in France. Now, this isn't new for the last few years, especially with the question of French citizens going to fight alongside jihadis in Syria. The French have ramped up intelligence services, and more money, means, and recruitment have been focused on intelligence and security services in France. Obviously, we had the Charlie Hebdo attacks just 10 months ago. So this has been a concern of French authorities recently. But I think now, clearly, this has become the defining issue of the Hollande presidency.
That's Benjamin Haddad of the Hudson Institute. Now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. Well, of course, there's been a really tremendous outpouring of support across social media for the victims of Friday's attacks. It's been a trending topic on Facebook since Friday. Lots of people talking about it on Twitter as well. Hashtag PrayForParis was used in nearly 4 million tweets Friday night, according to the Twitter analytics site Topsy. And Facebook activated its safety check feature, which allows people to notify their friends that they're safe. It was the first time the social media site had done so for an incident that wasn't a natural disaster. Lots of Facebook users then elected to shade their profile pictures red, white, and blue in solidarity for the victims of the attack.
I understand people were comparing the reactions with Paris to bombings in Beirut a day earlier.
That's right. The next day, the reaction shifted a little bit as people began to compare how social media treated the Paris attacks with those in Beirut, which, of course, had killed more than 40 people. A lot of people became dismayed by how much more support social media users gave for the victims in Paris. And then many people were asking why Facebook didn't activate its safety check feature after the Lebanon bombings. Others asking for an option to shade their profile pictures with a Lebanese flag. And now we have some people who have even shaded their profile pictures with multiple flags.
It's often easy for misinformation to spread with big breaking stories. Was that the case for Friday's attacks?
Certainly. And that's really the darker side of social media, how easy it is for false statements to come out and get spread around. Of course, multiple media outlets had tweeted out higher death counts Friday and had to then turn back and re-report the figures. Photos were also shared through social media of people who were purported to be the attackers, even though French authorities had not yet released any such photos. Of course, on Sunday, they did release the photo of Salah Abdeslam, and that's already been shared widely on social media. His name's actually one of the top trends on Twitter right now. But there's a distinct possibility in the immediate wake of these attacks for social media vigilantes to share photos that people may think are attackers, but in reality are just innocent people. And it's a testament to how easy it is for false information to be spread around on social media.
Thanks very much, Olin. That's Olin Akusholu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Winter, when days are short, will soon be upon those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. It's the short days that can play havoc with people's moods and well-being. Over 14 million Americans suffer from a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. While experts aren't really sure what causes SAD, some think it may be caused by a lack of sunlight in the winter. To treat SAD, some doctors and mental health experts have prescribed light therapy, where patients are exposed to very bright artificial light for 30 minutes or more each day. But a new study has found that cognitive behavioral therapy was much better at preventing SAD patients from relapsing in future winters than light therapy. The study shows that this special form of talk therapy teaches SAD patients to challenge their negative thoughts about dark winter months and resist behaviors like social isolation that can affect a person's mood. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new television series explores what would have happened if the Axis powers won World War II. A week after historic elections in Myanmar, Parliament convened what is expected to be its final session before the opposition National League for Democracy takes power in the new year. The Party of Democracy activists and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi took nearly 80% of the vote in the November 8th ballot, enough to form a majority government in a country dominated by the military for decades. The 70-year-old Nobel laureate, who is barred from becoming president because her late husband was British and her two sons hold foreign passports, says she will run the government, adding, "We will have a president who will work in accordance with the policies of the NLD." Yet she's taken a conciliatory approach to the current leadership by requesting meetings with President Thein Sein, the parliamentary speaker, and the army chief. President Thein Sein has promised a smooth transition period. Nicholas Farrelly, director of the Myanmar Research Center at the Australian National University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's a politically prudent move.
Aung San Suu Kyi has a great number of disadvantages. For a start, almost nobody in her political machine has any direct experience of running a 21st century political system. She is going to need to draw on a great deal of talent which exists elsewhere in the Myanmar system. She's also going to need to reassure those who have held these positions of great incumbency and privilege that they're not going to be immediately targeted for any kind of retribution. Aung San Suu Kyi's recent statements suggest that she acknowledges all of these potential problems and that she's going to do what it takes to ensure that this transition, which will be a first for absolutely everybody who's involved, is handled with a level of compassion and goodwill, and those are likely to be the ingredients for Myanmar's long-term success.
One analyst says, how will the public perceive her after she had to make compromises with political players that are deeply disliked and mistrusted? Can she remain the country's moral authority now that she has to make politics?
Since 2012, when Aung San Suu Kyi was first elected to the Union Assembly, she and her National League for Democracy colleagues have made a number of very significant compromises in terms of how they've interacted with a political system where most of the rules were established in the first instance to try and neuter the long-term influence of democratic voices. Aung San Suu Kyi has been playing this game now for a number of years. The Myanmar people appear to have a good understanding of what's involved and what's at stake. They seem to appreciate that Aung San Suu Kyi has been trying to gently unravel some of the legacies of dictatorial misrule, and seems to me, at least, that with the result that she's now received, with that incredible election victory, there is every chance that she will be able to further unwind some of the difficulties that the people of the country still experience on a day-to-day basis as she goes about turning Myanmar into a system which is more consistently and comprehensively democratic.
Nicholas, can she overcome the distrust from leaders of ethnic minorities and solve the long-simmering conflicts along the country's borders?
Aung San Suu Kyi's party did really well in ethnic minority areas, and I think that was a bit of a surprise to many analysts. Of course, nobody had good opinion polling material on which we could base any predictions about what would happen. But the fact that the NLD has achieved such a strong showing in so many different parts of the country where ethnic politics have tended over the long term to be the focus for so much local attention suggests that there are people in these areas who are putting their confidence and their trust in Aung San Suu Kyi. They want to see a permanent resolution to the country's ethnic difficulties.
That's Nicholas Fairley of the Australian National University. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new TV series from Amazon, The Man in the High Castle, takes viewers into a world where the Axis powers won World War II and have conquered the United States. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look at this series, a somewhat dystopian view of life under Nazi and Japanese occupation.
The Man in the High Castle is based on Philip K. Dick's 1962 novel of the same name and takes place in 1962. The Allies have lost World War II, and the United States is divided between the Nazis in the East and the Japanese Empire in the West, with a neutral zone between them. Juliana Crane lives in San Francisco, outwardly happy with Japanese rule. But when her half-sister Trudy is killed by the Kempeitai, Japan's equivalent of the SS, Juliana learns that what she thinks she knows might not be true. Before she dies, Trudy hands Juliana a film which contains newsreels of a different outcome, with the Allies winning World War II. Juliana thinks that perhaps the film shows the real world rather than the one in which she lives. Trudy was part of an American resistance and was carrying the film to the neutral zone to meet someone. Juliana decides to take Trudy's place. Rupert Evans stars as Frank Frink, Juliana's boyfriend and a Jew in Nazi-occupied New York.
Frank, I saw Trudy.
What?
I was in the market and I saw her.
You saw the pawns shoot her?
I know it sounds crazy, but I saw her.
Jules, we have to get out of here. The Kempeitai came to the factory today looking for the shooter.
Do you think they were looking for you?
Yeah, told me they didn't ask for anyone by name. I got out before they saw me. Look, the Kempeitai won't let this go until they've got someone.
Okay.
And now, with Arnold, Jules, I have to get out of here. And when they come looking for me, you can't be here either.
French-born American actress Alexa DeValos plays Juliana. She says that while some Americans might balk at the show's premise, it does touch on universal themes.
This takes you away from everything you know. And yet,
you know, there's an emotional connection to it. Pain is something that's obviously very timeless, and loss and fear and oppression and fascism and all these things are elements that we have today, unfortunately, and we had when the book was written and prior. So it's relatable, even though it's so incredibly different.
While in Colorado, Juliana meets and falls in love with Joe Blake, a 27-year-old New Yorker who volunteers to help the resistance. But he's really a Nazi double agent looking to infiltrate and betray resistance fighters. Luke Kleintank plays Joe Blake. He says that viewers might have difficulty accepting the show's premise, but will also find it intriguing.
You know, it's chilling. I think they're gonna have a hard time accepting it, but at the same time, I think they're gonna be intrigued by it. I mean, it's a piece of history that could have happened.
Frank Spotnitz is the show's producer, writer, and creator. He says that making the series reminded him of the huge debt the modern world owes to the World War II generation.
And what I've thought a lot about since embarking on this series is the sacrifices that this generation should be making to ensure that we live in a just world and that we live up to the ideals that, you know, our civilization stands for.
The Man in the High Castle also stars Rufus Sewell as John Smith, a ruthless Nazi SS officer. The Man in the High Castle is available to Amazon Prime subscribers beginning November 20th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What drives people, especially young men and women, to join brutal and exploitative terrorist groups like ISIL or Boko Haram? We must better understand these drivers if we are to counteract the ability of terrorists to recruit new members and prevent the formation of similar groups in the future. Individuals, even entire communities, may align with violent extremist groups for many complex reasons. Those who feel marginalized by society on the basis of politics, religious convictions, social or economic status, or other grievances may find terrorist propaganda persuasive and look to find meaning and acceptance within terrorist groups, which often provide a storyline that allows them to turn violence and inflicted on the society that had not fully accepted them. On a higher level, individuals and communities may seek meaning in radical ideologies and those who espouse them that seem to meet their needs for a purpose or identity. This means that in order to blunt the appeal of violent terrorist groups, we must find ways to fill unmet human needs. These can range from providing security to expanding economic options to giving marginalized communities a greater stake in determining their political future, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell. So we are increasing our work toward an approach to countering violent extremism that better prevents individuals and communities from wanting to align with terrorism in the first place. This includes building trust. It includes empowering a broader range of people, including civil society, businesses, religious leaders, women, youth, international bodies, and former violent extremists, to counter the false promises of groups such as ISIL and build more resilient communities. And it involves building a network of global partners, including regional and multilateral institutions such as the Arab League, United Nations, World Bank, African Union, and World Economic Forum, to reinforce the civilian-led components of this approach. In short, if we can remove or lessen the most insistent factors that motivate people to turn toward violence, then we can start replacing destructive ideas that uphold terrorism as a means of change with an avenue toward individual and community improvement and hope for a better future. As President Barack Obama said, "Ideologies are not defeated with guns. They're defeated by better ideas, a more attractive and compelling vision."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.